All right, again, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's really nice to see everybody, old and new friends, and friends who we haven't seen for a while, so this is a treat. It's also a treat for me because I'm a public servant, and usually when I'm speaking, the faces aren't all as warm and friendly and supportive. So this is a pretty lovely experience for me, sort of. As lovely as it can be. So as Kate said, I'm going to talk today about Buddha's robe, something that's an important part of my practice, partly because people have started to call me a robe sewing teacher, and partly because I've learned a lot about the Dharma through sewing and wearing of the robe. And as Kate mentioned, this is my robe. This is actually Buddha's robe. It's called a raka suit. And maybe I'll just explain a bit of the terminology. So the kesa, which is the larger robe that Kate and Michael are wearing, is the Japanese term for the full robe that priests wear and teachers wear. It's also known as a kashaya in, I think, Pali or Sanskrit. So you'll hear those words when I talk, because a lot of what I'm saying or reciting comes from Buddha's first talks about the robe and about monks' rules that were contained in the Vinaya. Now, the other term you might hear, of course, is raka suit, and this is actually considered a robe, but it's just a smaller form. But the format and the pattern are basically the same. And in all cases of receiving Buddha's robe, a student is expressing their dedication and their commitment to becoming free of their habitual patterns of thought and action, and receiving the precepts, which is their aspiration to act accordingly in order to free themselves from their old habitual patterns. It's not a great explanation. Hopefully Kate and Michael will maybe give a more extensive discussion or talk about that next week. So practitioners in many spiritual traditions wear robes or habits or gowns that identify them as committed to a certain path. Our Soto Zen tradition is no different. If you look around, you'll see these shapes and colors. Raka suits are usually, in our tradition, blue. Robes, the full robes of priests or priests in training are black. And that's what Kate and Michael wore before they were given Dharma transmission to signify them as teachers, upon which they were able to wear or came to wear the brown robes. So our priests wear the robes, and they're not so unusual. People walk in off the street and come to the Zendo for the first time, and they go, okay, yeah, they're wearing robes. But they often ask about these. So this is my main experience, but hopefully through the course of this talk, you'll learn more about the tradition of both the kesa and the raka suit. So I'll start by describing some of the more exotic aspects of robes, and then bring us back down to earth by talking about some of the more mundane details about robe sewing and wearing the robe, an important tradition in many Zen sanghas. So you might be relieved to know that by having so many people around here wearing okesas and rakasus, we're likely all well protected from being devoured by a gold-winged Garuda. So, no need to worry there. We also won't have to worry too much about dragons, fish, or other harmful beings who might be lurking in the ocean just nearby. Buddha's robe is so powerful, in fact, that by obtaining even a small piece of one, a dragon can be cured of febrile diseases. If an ox touches Buddha's robe with one of its horns, its past wrongdoings disappear. If only we had horns, right? These claims about Buddha's robe are recounted by Dogen Zenji, the founder of our Soto Zen lineage. They, of course, came from early talks by the Buddha on the robe. But I'm not sure if I'm quite there with Dogen or Buddha on these great magical powers of the robe. And perhaps these claims are more metaphorical. But I believe that sewing and wearing Buddha's robe is an important practice that goes beyond just wearing the team colors. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our Soto Zen lineage, thought that this practice was important as well, as there are two chapters devoted to his teachings about Buddha's robe in the Shobogenzo. That's the book of his teachings compiled 8 centuries ago, seven, something like that, also known as the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. Dogen had an early encounter with the robe when he was in China. He had gone to China in the hopes of finding more authentic practice and teaching than he had found in Japan at the time. It was in China that he first saw monks place their robes on the top of their head and chant the robe chant, something that moved him to tears. If you've been to any of our retreats, you might recall the chant. It starts, Dai Sai Ge Da Pu Ku. And we chant that twice. And the English translation is, Great Robe of Liberation, Field Far Beyond Form and Emptiness, Wearing the Tathagata's Teaching, Saving All Beings. So the first two verses are in Pali and would have been the same verses that Dogen heard. And they're verses that are chanted all over the world, even today. So when we chant that, I always get the feeling of being connected over space with other people in the rest of the world and over time with people in the past, long, long ago, who have chanted this. So it's quite moving for me, but also quite settling. So this event in China was likely the beginning of Dogen's profound faith in the robe as a direct physical link to Buddha's teaching, passed down as part of the face-to-face transmission of the Dharma through the lineage of teachers leading back to Buddha. Here's one description, or Dogen's description, of this lineage. The Tathagata Shakyamuni entrusted the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the unsurpassable enlightenment, to Maha Kashyapa, along with the Kashaya, or robe, which had been transmitted by his teacher, Kashyapa Buddha. The robe was transmitted heir to heir for 33 generations to Huineng. The shape, color, and measurements were intimately transmitted. After that, Dharma descendants of Qinyuang and Nanwei, transmitting the Dharma, sewed and wore the ancestral Dharma. The teaching of washing and maintaining the robe was not known except by those who studied in the chamber of a master who had transmitted this teaching face to face. For Dogen, this transmission of teaching through the robe made it more than just a symbol of our spiritual ancestry, as indicated in this description, again from the Shobogenzo. Those who arouse the aspiration for enlightenment should without fail receive the authentic transmission of the ancestors. As Dharma descendants, we have not only encountered the rarely encountered Buddha Dharma, but we have seen, studied, and received the authentically transmitted Buddha Kashaya. In this way, we see the Tathagata. We hear the Buddha expound the Dharma. We are illuminated by the Buddha. We enjoy the Buddha's enjoyment. we receive the one-to-one transmission of the Buddha's mind, and we attain Buddha's marrow. Thus, we are intimately wrapped in the Kshaya of Shakyamuni Buddha. We personally accompany the Buddha and receive this Kshaya from the Buddha. So, pretty moving words. A part of what I understand Dogen to say is that wearing the robes goes beyond just putting on the club colors or the team's baseball cap. Just like words are only labels that we stick on events or objects to describe a very circumscribed reality at a single point in time, our practice is to go beyond words and experience things as they really are. With the robe, I think Dogen is encouraging us to deeply understand and experience the practice of the robe, sewing and wearing it. But now I'd like to come back down to earth a bit and see if I can describe some of the practical aspects of our robe tradition. So as you've probably heard in other stories, Buddha left his sheltered life when he was a young man to devote himself to answering the questions of suffering, of sickness, old age, and death. As was the custom of the day, he traded his fine clothing for that of a spiritual seeker. From what we read in the old sutras, these robes would have been made from scraps of discarded cloth, or in Sanskrit, pamsuta. The types of cloth described were cloth that had been burned by fire, chewed on by oxen, gnawed by mice, or worn by the dead. The Japanese equivalent of pamsuta is funzoi, a polite translation of which is excrement-sweeping cloth. Dogen includes some recommendations on how to retrieve such cloth from the toilet. We don't do that here. Just so you know. The cloth would be washed and sewn, piecemeal and without pattern, into a rectangle large enough to wrap around a monk's body. The rectangle was then dyed using a variety of vegetation, roots, leaves, that sort of thing, which resulted in a kind of variable and muddy color known in Sanskrit as kshaya, denoting mixed, neutral, or earth tones. It's also defined as color that is not pure or bad color. Purification of the cloth and the robe comes later when the robe is transmitted to a student. But this generic formless cloth of the monk meant that the robes of followers of all spiritual traditions would look the same. Or at least their clothes would look the same. They probably wouldn't look the same. One of the Buddha's followers and patrons, King Bimbisara, had a problem with this, as he wanted to pay homage to Buddha's monks, not monks of other traditions. There's a tale where he apparently got down from his elephant and bowed down before a monk who wasn't one of Buddha's followers, and he was a little bit disturbed by this. So he complained about this confusion and asked Buddha to choose a robe that would set his monks apart. Sometime later, Buddha was walking by a rice field with his attendant Ananda. He asked whether it would be possible to design a robe based on the orderly, staggered patterns of rows of the rice paddy fields, as well as the paths between them. Ananda set to work. The result was a rectangular patchwork with seams that overlap from top to bottom and from center to the outer edge. It's also known as the wet rice paddy pattern. Buddha's teaching, or this pattern is said by some to symbolize Buddha's teaching, which flows down to all parts of a field, like water in a rice paddy nourishing the growing plants. The kesa nourishes the aspiration of the practitioner. The pattern has changed somewhat since that time, and different cultures and traditions have slightly different patterns and colors. But the concept of the rice field and the patch nature of the robe remain. At some point, it's not clear exactly when or where the rakasu or small version of the robe was developed. Some say it was developed during the transition to manual labor in China, as monks weren't supported by alms from the population and had to support themselves. A rakasu would have been much easier to wear than a long flowing robe when plowing the fields and weeding. Others say the rakasu came about during a period of persecution so that Buddhists could wear the kesa, hidden and safe, under their outer clothing. Through different cultures and different times, colors and fabrics also changed according to circumstances. But what about the tradition of sewing the robe? It's a question that often comes up when we tell people that prior to doing jukai, or taking the precepts, they're going to need to sew their own rakasus. Sewing our own robes is a tradition which comes from the San Francisco Zen Center, and before that, from Sawaki Kodo Roshi. It goes back much further than that, of course, when monks had to sew their own robes because there weren't places that manufactured them. I learned most of what I know of Sawaki Kodo Roshi and his sewing tradition from an American scholar, Diane Riggs, who also happens to be a Zen priest ordained at San Francisco Zen Center. Sawaki Kodo was a Soto Zen teacher, a Dogen scholar, and a rebel. Through his study of Dogen's teachings on the kesa, he became convinced that it was essential to maintain the practice of sewing one's robe, one's own robe. At around the same time as he came to that conclusion, however, the Soto Zen administration in Japan was becoming concerned with the growing number of different designs that people had for their robes and decided to establish a standard form. They laid out some official sewing instructions and authorized only two manufacturers in all of Japan who could make the robes and sell them to Soto priests and lay people. Sawaki Roshi was, I don't know what he was. I wrote appalled, but then I thought, I don't know how he felt. he was concerned with how the Soto Zen administration had essentially created a monopoly, which could then set its own price for robes. Today, as Diane Riggs notes in her writing, the cases cost hundreds to thousands of dollars each. I think she's probably talking about the full cases rather than the rakasus. I've gone online myself and found there are usually a few hundred depending on whether you get machine or handmade ones. The clergy basically order their robes by phone and have little, if any, direct contact with the robe maker. It just arrives in the mail. Sawaki Roshi decided that he would learn more about the design and making of the robes. He learned how to sew robes from two nuns who came from the Shingon sect of Zen, who apparently had robes similar to his old teacher's robes. Sawaki Kodo began to lecture on the history and traditions of the kesa and eventually began sewing groups at various temples known as fukudenkai, or field of merit groups. Robe sewing was first introduced at San Francisco Zen Center after Katagiri Roshi, who was teaching at and helping out at San Francisco Zen Temple, when Katagiri Roshi convinced Suzuki Roshi to form sewing groups for his students. Yoshida Eshin Roshi, abbess at Kaizenji in Japan, was the first teacher to come from Japan to teach sewing. Later, a student of Sawaki Kodo Roshi's, Rengetsu Kasai Joshin, or Joshin Roshi, came to teach. By all accounts, she was quite beloved by her students, and I've read several stories describing her warmth, her encouragement, and her absolute dedication to sewing practice, staying up late at night to finish robes, to help students. I guess she was pretty amazing. I sewed my rakusu and received the precepts in 2003. I definitely didn't find it easy. In fact, I found the Japanese sewing methods contradicted much of what I'd previously learned in more Western styles of sewing. I chafed at the methods for making corners and questioned why one couldn't trim seams to make them fold over more easily. I wondered why we stitched in a direction opposite to the way I'd always stitched. The sewing teacher from San Francisco had gone home a long time before, so it was just me and a sewing manual. And for those of you who've ever seen the sewing manual, yeah. Not easy to understand. I'm not sure if it was good to sew mostly alone, but it certainly gave me the time and silence to really observe all of these stories about sewing that were going on in my own head. Aside from the frustration-laden technical questions I just mentioned, there were lots of questions, too, about sewing as a women's practice. As I grew up, I had become more aware of how our culture oppresses women, in part by expectations of the domestic skills they should have, such as sewing. I thought I shouldn't spend too much time on these things because that could just deepen my oppression, and maybe all women's oppression. At a certain point, though, I realized I had to let go of these ideas if I wanted to be serious and continue my Zen practice, at least this Zen practice, which I'd started. I needed to accept the teaching that sewing the rakusu offered. In a way, it allowed me to see a lot of my attachments and the limits of my understanding, and that if I didn't practice with these, I would never get beyond them. At the very least, it allowed me to see how my mind just goes over and over the same concepts and complaints and doubts, as it always does. In this way, sewing the rakusu became like zazen. As I stitched, thoughts would arise, and then in order to proceed to the next stitch, because you can really only do one thing at a time, I would let the thoughts go. Each breath, each stitch, is completely new. And the more I practice, the more I feel this. Whether it's with each breath in zazen or each stitch in sewing, I get to witness how the old ideas created by my karmic life don't need to determine my next action. I just take my next breath and sew my next stitch. I think Jean Selkirk, the sewing teacher at Berkeley Zen Center, and someone who's also very dedicated to the sewing tradition and who's helped me a lot, says it eloquently in her introduction to the booklet she compiled called Buddha's Robe is Sewn. So here's her quote. In sewing, as in anything, the truly mysterious is manifest. Even when the stitches seem endless, we just focus on the details of the process. Despite preference and choice, when we just plunge in and let go of the outcome, those seamless moments arise when the needle and stitches, breathing and chanting, just happen. The careful weighing of myriad decisions needs no more thought, and the caring becomes indistinguishable from the action. The field far beyond form arises. Thank you.
Page 3.